Hey, welcome to the Orchard, man. I'm really excited about sharing today. And I'm going to ask you to sit up straight. Everyone sit up straight and lean in, because what we're talking about, this is one of those talks where all week, as I've been kind of working on this, I realized some of what we're going to talk about has the potential to completely change your life. So sit up straight and listen well. When I was a kid, I would engage in something that, this is going to be hard for most people to believe, but I would engage in what my mom would call at times unacceptable behavior. And hey, it's shocking, believe me, I know. Completely foreign to my ears to hear that I could actually do something wrong and make a mistake as a child. I know you probably thought I was the perfect kid. My mom would ground me to my room as sort of a response to the things that I did. And we didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have video games. And I didn't have much in my room. But what I did have was this little old black and white TV. Remember the little black and white TVs with the little, like, well, it used to have bunny rabbit ears, but when I got it, it had a hanger, you know, and it was kind of bent, and that's what you would adjust and get, like, PBS and NBC or something. I had that. I had an old boom box. Remember those big radios in the early 80s? And that's pretty much it. I had an old Royal typewriter, and when I'd get in trouble, my mom would take everything out of my room except for my bed and my pillow and my blanket and my clothes and my dresser and this old stack of books that were laying over in the corner. All the rest of that stuff was taken out, and that was sort of, that was her way of punishing me. Now, I've said this before, but I have an incredibly active imagination. Anyone else like that? Your mind just, you could just dream up all sorts of things. And so, when I read fiction, it's like someone turned a movie projector on in my head. I mean, it's like I closed my eyes almost. I could smell the place that I was reading about. I could see the faces, the facial expressions of the people that I was reading about. I could visualize the room that they were in and the setting and the places they were going and what all that looked like. And so what my mom thought was punishment really was an opportunity for my young imagination to take hold and to grow and to really provide some built-in entertainment. I rode riverboats with Tom Sawyer, and I'll never forget the first time we kissed Becky Thatcher. That was awesome. You know, Huck Finn and I hung out. We got in a lot of trouble in those days. I remember seeing the expression of Captain Ahab as he and the nuance in his voice as he screamed at Moby Dick. As a kid, I journeyed to the center of the earth. I experienced a mutiny on the Bounty. And that's sort of what my imagination did. And I've come to realize that nearly all children possess this capability to look at things that aren't and imagine them into existence. And even to this day, I watch my 11-year-old son. He started over Christmas break, and he read the entire seven volume of Harry Potter in about 5 weeks. And one time I grilled him because I thought, there's no way you're actually retaining this. Like, you're skipping pages, because I know myself too well, and I went to college. I know what that's like. You know, especially graduate school, there's so much reading. You can't possibly read every word, okay? Don't take that advice from me if you're in grad school. So I started grilling him about, like, what was happening in the book, and he was able to tell us, like, fact after fact after fact. And this kid has amazing retention. But I see, even at the age of 11, he's got this really developed sense of imagination. I think most kids can look through the pages of a book, and they can visualize worlds that they never dreamed possible. And I think when we were kids, we looked at life in the same way, didn't we? We sort of looked on the pages of our life, and we could visualize what the story of our life was going to look like. And for me, I wanted to be a rock star and an actor and a doctor and a writer and a filmmaker. And I was too naive to realize that I couldn't possibly do all of those things at the same time. I just thought, well, I don't know if I thought I was going to be James Bond or what. I'm like the man, you know. So it would be sort of an odd combination to be, you know, a rock star, and you're doing a show, and then there's a mosh pit, and someone gets banged up, and so you step off the stage, and you do the stitches, you get back on, you finish the rock show, and then you drive over to the set of your new film, and you're like shooting all night long, and in the morning, you dismiss the cast and crew, and you dive back into work writing your newest novel. I was too dumb to know that you couldn't do all of those things. Well, the truth is, I could look down the pages of my life as a very young child, and I could visualize moments of greatness, moments of significance, moments of impact where I just might be able to do something really cool with my life. How about you? I think we all start there as young kids, and we look down the pages of our lives and we visualize moments of greatness, but all too often we find ourselves in the middle or at the end of our lives wondering where all those moments went and feeling like all the good moments passed us by or they happened to someone else. And it's like we've lost our sense of imagination and wonder about what the future could look like. And we've settled for a life that's boring and mundane and safe. A number of years ago, I started reading this book called Chasing Daylight by Irwin McManus. And it's one of those books that's sort of the top five for me in the sense that it influenced the way that I see the world and that I think about the world. And he talks about this concept that our lives are sort of the cumulative of five or six or seven key defining moments in our life. Those five or six or seven key moments or decisions that directly impacted the direction of our life. And those moments for us, often they're turning points where we make a decision about what direction we're going to go. And based on the result of that decision, it greatly affects the course of our life. And our lives are the cumulative sum of those moments in our lives. They define who we are and what we do. An example might be when we're a kid and we do something humiliating in front of the class and everyone laughs at us. And isn't it weird how we can be in our 30s or 40s or our 60s or 70s when you think back to a moment as a child where we were humiliated in front of someone else and we still feel it fresh. You know what I'm talking about? Am I the only one that had those moments? Nod your head to next spiritual. Here we go. Okay. Maybe it's the time that you hit the winning run in the Little League game. Maybe it's when your parents sat you down and said, honey, we love you, but mom and I are getting a divorce. It's not about you, it's about us. Maybe it's the time that you look back and it's the day that you got married. Maybe it's the time that you welcomed your child into the world. Maybe it's the decision to start a business or what career path you chose. We can all look through our lives, and the truth is we can pause and examine sort of the pages of our own story. And we can think of those five or six moments that were like pinnacles. There's a lot of other stuff that happens in between those, but there are five or six key moments that really make us who we are. And I've thought about this a lot. I think I can clearly see a handful of those moments in my own life. The first moment for me actually started before I was even born. And it's hard even to imagine, even as I utter these words. But my father got killed in a car accident about 5 days before I was born. That was an impacting moment for me. And it thrust my mom and my family into a situation of managed chaos where they welcomed this new life into the world. And at the same time, they said goodbye to another. I can't even imagine what that must have been like for my mom and for my family. And it launched my life into chaos and a very difficult childhood. And it's a moment that I certainly didn't choose. It chose me. My other moments are moments that most of us experience at some point in their life. And you might see it in your own life as, oh, that was just an average moment. But for me, they were sort of like the pinnacle, those sort of huge moments for me. One was when I was about 10 years old, and this elderly couple took me to church with them, and I started hearing about the goodness of God and the love of Jesus, and I made a decision that I wanted to follow this guy, even at that young age. Getting married was a pretty significant event for me, and hopefully it was for you too. That was a big deal because I didn't have a lot of healthy family life modeled in my life. And so I had to make a choice to be committed here. And that's a big commitment, isn't it? Having kids and choosing to be responsible, that was a really big moment for me. And going, you know what? I grew up and I was born into a world of chaos, but I want to choose now and do my very, very best to make sure that that does not happen to my own kids. And I can honestly say, with my oldest, almost 12, my youngest turned 6 a couple of days ago, I've done the best that I can. And so when I think about my life in those cumulative moments, I can sum them up into, you know, about 5 moments. And here's some words that describe those: tragedy, redemption, decision, commitment, responsibility. That's pretty wild, isn't it, to take one guy's life and to cram it into those moments. There was a lot of other stuff that happened in between. Those really do make me who I am. And the thing about moments is they're equal opportunity employers. Did you know that? Moments are sitting out there for all of us. They're equal opportunity. They reveal themselves to all of us. And I love the power of moments because they're pregnant with possibility. Moments are like atoms. I don't mean Adam, the guy that did announcements. I'm talking about that little unit of spatial measurement, that teeny tiny atom. They're little bitty, right? Very, very small. Maybe someone knows how big they actually are. But it's hard for me to even imagine. But an atom is this teeny tiny measurement. But it's full of power, isn't it? And scientists have figured that out, that atoms are actually full of power. They're little bitty, but they have all of this power. And so we can compress those atoms or we can split those atoms. And what actually happens is they release what? Energy. And the energy that's contained in atoms can be used either for good or for bad. True? True. I think moments are like an atom. They're amoral. They come along and we're able to see them. And I think what I found to be true is there's two different ways that we see moments in our life. There's two sort of people in the way that they see them. There are those of us that see moments in the rearview mirror. Those are us who sit at the end of our life and we wonder where it all went. And we wonder why it didn't happen for us. And then there are those people who see moments coming. They see them as divine opportunities, divine moments to step in and to seize the power of that moment and to release the power and let it do something fantastic in our lives. And the bottom line is, it's a matter of perspective. We get to choose. We're all capable of dreaming about our lives and what the future looks like in that sort of childlike, mysterious, inviting way. We're all capable of leaning into the defining moments of our lives. Whatever we choose to do with the moments that come along really define the quality and the direction of our lives. Think about that. That's kind of heavy. I want to look today at a story in the Bible. This is really one of my favorite stories in all of the scriptures, and it's really cool because it's a story of two people who face the same moment in history with the same opportunity, the same challenges, and the same set of resources. Yet they make remarkably different decisions about how to engage in this moment. And it's found in the first book of 1 Samuel, chapter 14. But before we go there, I want to back up a chapter and just sort of set the stage here for what's going on. In chapter 13, the nation of Israel is at war. You remember the young king Saul? He gets crowned king at only 30 years of age. Can you even imagine being responsible for an entire kingdom at 30 years of age? So Saul takes 3,000 men from Israel to be his fighting force, and his young son Jonathan takes these 3,000 men and attacks a Philistine outpost. And so Israel has 3,000 soldiers ready for battle. The Philistines show up with their arsenal, and look at what the scripture says. The Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Oops. I don't think that Israel probably would have chosen to engage in this war if they had realized that the Philistine army was so massive. I mean, think about that. The soldiers as numerous as the sands on the seashore. What's that saying? That's a lot of people. Unless you have a very tiny beach, okay? I'm thinking lots and lots of people. It's not like a handful of sand. We're talking about a mile of beach. I can't even imagine how much sand is in there. This is sort of an ancient way of saying that Israel was up a creek, and the deck was clearly stacked against them. And so this Israeli army, they did what any right-thinking person would do in that scenario. Most of them did what? They bailed. They ran, they fled, and they hid in caves and in cisterns. And some people even got out of the country and said, I'm not doing this. So Saul, he camps out at this place called Gilgal, and he has some troops with him. And the scriptures say these troops were quaking with fear. So all of your people have left. All of your resources are gone. There are thousands and thousands of soldiers lining up ready to nail you. You'd probably be quaking in fear, wouldn't you? Now, I read this, I put myself in their shoes, and I think this means they're doing what you and I would be doing too. They were peeing their Hebrew pants. That's what was happening. So Saul, he hunkers down and waits because the great prophet Samuel says, I'll be back in 7 days. And so Saul's waiting, but he starts to get impatient. Come on, Samuel, where are you, man? Where are you? We're a little outnumbered. And so he decides to take matters into his own hands. Instead of trusting God's prophet, he sets up a burnt offering to God in hopes that he could earn favor with God in this situation. And of course, about that time, Samuel shows up and says, what are you doing? And Saul says, well, you know, you didn't come, and I didn't know what to do, and so I made this offering, thinking God would be pleased. And Samuel shook his head and said, you've just earned your ticket right on out of your kingdom. Because of your disobedience, God's going to take your kingdom from you. That's pretty heavy, isn't it? And to make matters worse, the Philistines, they sent out soldiers to basically kidnap all of the blacksmiths in all of Israel. Why would they do that? Because blacksmiths were the only one that could make what? Weapons. You kind of need weapons to fight a war. So they abduct all of these people. They take all of the swords and all of the plowshares and all of the weapons in all of Israel. And the only thing that's left are two swords, one that Saul has and one that Jonathan, his young son, has. And so Israel, the army of Israel, found themselves at their lowest point. With no weapons, no ability to make weapons, they faced this army whose numbers were as big as the sands on the seashore. And to top it all off, the Philistine army is gathering up on top of this cliff within eyesight view of the Israelis, and they're getting ready to come down and take care of business. Would you be intimidated? This is yes. This is no. This is, what day is it? Okay. You know, I know people who seem to go through life and it seems like everything just works out in their favor. You know people like that? I mean, they get the perfect job. They have the perfect hair. You know, I have some hairs. They have the perfect hair. They have perfect teeth. They seem to stumble into the perfect opportunities time and time again. But I don't know about you, but unlike those people, it seems like to me the moments that are presented to me are always a little bit like this. I feel like my life is a lot like this story. It seemed like pulling teeth for me to get good things in my life. And so much of my life, I felt like full of energy and dreams and all these things that I wanted to do, but I just didn't have the resources to do it. And it seemed like the deck was stacked against me. Can you relate to that? I'm a lot less of the GQ guy and a lot more of the what day is it guy, okay? So we picked the story up here, 1 Samuel 14. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men. So these 3,000 people that Saul had, he thought, these are my warriors, my fighting guys, we have no weapons. A bunch of them have bailed, and now he's stuck with only 600 people with no weapons. And he's sitting underneath this tree, and he feels defeated. And he knows that his kingdom's about to be taken from him because of his lack of obedience. His army's dwindled down to only 600 people. And he has one dinky sword and no other resources. He can see the Philistine army up on this cliff nearby, marching in formation, getting ready to come down and wipe out his people. And here we see this powerful king who, not too long before that, had access to everything he could possibly imagine. And now all of his resources are gone. And so what does he do? He gives up. And he sits underneath this pomegranate tree. He looked at this moment and said, oh, what can I do? Wouldn't you do that too? I probably would, if I'm being honest. His young son, Jonathan, he looks at this moment in a little bit different of a way. Jonathan says to his young armor bearer, come, let's go over to the outpost of these uncircumcised men. Question, how did he know they were uncircumcised? That's just a question. Let's move on. At lunch today, someone's going, oh, I get it. Oh, that's weird. All right. So then he says something that I think is amazing in so many ways. And this statement that Jonathan says has absolutely transformed the way that I think about life when I look down the pages of my life. And I'm going to ask you to read this with me. Read this with me. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. I don't know about you, but I'm a research junkie. When I know that I need to do something, I like to research all that I can about it, probably too much. I want to figure out as much information as I possibly can about that thing. So Jonathan stands up here and says, hey, let's do this. And the best he can offer is perhaps the Lord can act on our behalf. Perhaps. If it were me, I think I'd want to know, like, how do you know that this is what we should do? I need you to tell me that last night while we were sleeping, God appeared to you, and this drum line of angels came down and said, we're going to defeat the Philistines. You know, I need you to do something like that. Or tell me that God confirmed to you in some way that we're not about to become mincemeat for these people. But that's not the response that his armor bearer had. And I can tell you, it's a good thing I wasn't his armor bearer. The armor bearer says, do all that you have in mind. Go ahead. I'm with you heart and soul. He's crazy. What about us? I think for most of us, we look at a moment in time, and it's easy to miss an opportunity because we wait for absolute certainty that God's going to show up and do his thing. And we settle into a life of mediocrity because our theology at some point in our life evolved to this place where we believe that when God calls us to do something, he reveals all the answers in that moment. Have you ever been in that place? I know I have. And I don't know about you, but for me, it's rarely felt like God showed me 100% of the path. In my life, following God and choosing to lean into a moment versus huddling in fear and waiting for all the answers, it's been very, very scary and very, very difficult. And it's like that scene on Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade. You remember where he's going and he goes to this deep ledge. There's this ledge that is facing, it's almost like a bottomless pit. Remember that? And there's an invisible bridge there. And Indiana Jones comes to this place that we all find in life where he has a crisis of faith. He has to wrestle with, what am I going to do? I've got to get over there, but there's no bridge here. So he tests the waters a little bit, and he throws a few stones. And the filmmakers did such a phenomenal job of showing us the angst on his face as he took a deep breath, and he put his foot out there. He had no certainty that he wasn't about to fall to his death. And he stepped out and just trusted that it was all going to work out in the end. I think all too often we wait and we wait and wait to chase after God and settle for a life that's boring and complacent because we over-spiritualize the journey. We over-spiritualize the journey. I've actually been in conversations with people where it's almost like they're trying to justify how boring and mundane and sterile their lives are. It's like they're trying to convince me and themselves of, it's cool that my life is boring and I don't do anything. And they use flowery spiritual language to justify their existence instead of just admitting that life is freaking scary sometimes, isn't it? And they don't want to just admit that they're just waiting and wishing that all the I's would be dotted and all the T's would be crossed. And they use words like, I'm just waiting on God. In reality, their spiritual cause for waiting is really underneath all that. It's laziness or fear. And they won't admit it. And they want to sound spiritual and say things that give them out from doing what God calls them to do. And we convince ourselves that we don't have the resources that we need to step into a moment that God's placed right in front of us. And just like Saul, we're rendered useless. But Jonathan wasn't prepared to live like that. Unlike his father, who saw this moment as a moment to sit and to pout, Jonathan saw it as an opportunity for God to show up and do something really spectacular. And his armor bearer was ready to back him up 100%. And look what happens. Jonathan said, come on then, we will cross over toward them and let them see us. If they say to us, wait over there until we come to you, we will stay where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands. So Jonathan basically says, we're going to come out from hiding, we're going to reveal ourselves to these thousands of guys up on this cliff, and if they tell us to stay, no, that basically means we're going to sit here and die. But if they say, come up to us, that's now the sign that God has chosen to deliver them into our hands. Now, when I read this again, I may be a little too skeptical, but if I were the armor bearer, I'd start asking some serious questions. Jonathan, let's have a little strategy meeting here, okay? Let's talk about this, okay? Let me just get this straight. Are you sure about this? And how exactly did you decide on these particular parameters of, like, we stay, they tell us to come down, you know, the whole thing? And explain to me how exactly them inviting us up a cliff so that they could teach us a lesson, how is that God delivering them into our hands? Versus, I don't know, maybe dying a certain death. So the crazy armor bearer, who was clearly on something, he trusts Jonathan and he went along with it. And so both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. So the Philistines come out and say, look, the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in. The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson. And Jonathan hears this and he gets a little bit giddy and he says to his armor bearer, climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. That sounds like crazy talk to me. I'm just saying. Hey, we're crazy outnumbered, and they shouted to us to to come up so they could teach us a lesson. That's quite obviously a sign that, the Lord has delivered them into our hands. If it were me, Jonathan would have said that, and then he would have turned around and realized that he was talking to himself, because I would have hightailed it on out of there a long time before that, wouldn't you? Yeah, he would have turned around, because the facts simply didn't add up. And I think in our lives, we wait until we know what to do before we do anything at all. But I think we can learn from this story that in a life chasing God, sometimes we just have to just do something. Would you say that with me? Just do something. Look at the person that you came here with today and say this to them. Just do something. I don't think you're convinced, so I want you to shout this out. Just do something. You don't always have the plan. You don't always have that. It's easier to play it safe and comfortable sometimes than to embrace the life that God has given to us. And Irwin speaks to this, and this quote blows my mind. He says this: all too often, people relinquish the life they were created to live for a life they can create themselves. That's a life that does not take faith. We're too afraid to jump into the life God created for us, and so we move into this life that we can easily like figure out all the parameters and schedule it out and make it safe and easy. And that's exactly what Saul did, isn't it? He camped out under this tree and did nothing. And you know what happened? His son stepped into a moment that was designed for his father. That's a pretty big deal. Saul was afraid because he had put his trust in the provisions of the weapons of war, and guess what? He didn't have any. Jonathan was excited because he put his trust in the possibility that God would show up. And it's only in that sort of life that we can live this sort of breathless life. You know, you're chasing God, and it's scary, but it's also exhilarating, and it's fun because we step into moments instead of looking at them in the rearview mirror, and it's in those moments that we see that God showed himself faithful and good. So look at verse 13. Jonathan climbed up using his hands and his feet with his armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. Notice that little detail. How did he get up the cliff? With his hands and his feet. He didn't have an arsenal. He didn't take a helicopter, or he didn't have an Iron Man suit that, you know, came over the top. He climbs up this cliff. And that's intimidating to me because I think these guys are looking, you know, peering at him, but that's what he did. He used what he had in front of him. He had very little resources, yet he used his hands and his feet to propel him into this moment. And what about us? I think often we stand in front of a moment and we're so focused on the resources we do not have that we miss maybe the couple of things that are in our life that we do have that we could use to jump into a moment. You know, maybe you're in a situation today where you've lost your job and you've been searching and you're waiting for someone to hire you. What resources do you have? What's God put in front of you? What skills do you have that can propel you forward? Maybe you're in a situation where the deck really seems stacked against you in life. What do you have right in front of you? How could God use your hands and your feet to get you moving forward? Remember how he said to just do something instead of just waiting for God to show up and answer all the questions. So Jonathan and this armor bearer, they climb this cliff, and they kill the first few people they saw. In verse 14, it says, in that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area about half an acre. So in no time flat, Jonathan and his armor bearer get up there, and with one sword and with their you know, like these huge biceps like mine, you know, something like that, they wipe out about 20 guys, and then the story really starts getting good. Verse 15, then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field, and those in the outposts and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. So Jonathan, he steps out in faith, and they kill about 20 people in no time flat. And guess what happens? God steps in, and he sends this earthquake, and the whole Philistine army panics. They thought a massive army were overtaking them, and they freak out. Now, let's cut to the scene where Saul's sitting under this pomegranate tree. And remember, he's been looking up on top of this cliff, remember? And on top, he sees the Philistines marching, doing their thing. Now what does he see? Dust, chaos, people running, mass confusion. And he goes, something is going on. And so Saul stands up, and he says, let's count and figure out. Someone's gone from our camp. Who is it? And he finds out it's his son, Jonathan. And he shouts and goes, let's get up. Let's go after them. And so they do. All of these people jump after them. And even the people who had deserted the Israeli army realized, hey, I think we might be in a good place here with God. And so I'm going to join the team again. And so they jump in and they run to the top and they find the Philistines so confused that they are actually killing one another. And so the Israelis were able just to go, okay, let's just let you do your thing here, you know. Okay, whittle them down. I think we're done here. Great. The scripture says that on that day, the Lord saved Israel and the battle moved beyond Beth Aven. That's a powerful story, isn't it? And I think we learn a lot from this. We can learn that we can look at a moment, a decisive opportunity in our lives, and we have the power to see it as God sees it. Sort of this perspective where this moment is like an atom. It's latent energy waiting to be unleashed. And we could see God move in a way that we never could do if we simply sat and waited and let moments happen to us. Because when we settle for those things, when we just sit and let them happen to us, that's when we find ourselves at the end of our life confused and wondering why it never happened for us, why God never moved and did spectacular things in our life. And believe me, I know it's incredibly difficult to think about striking out to do things without everything spelled out. If it were me, I'd rather have, you know, if God could just give me sort of a digital spreadsheet that said, you know, step one, step two, step three, contingency plan here, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? The nerds are like, yes. Those who aren't nerds are going, what's a spreadsheet? God doesn't usually give me the 5-year plan. How about you? Often, for me, it's like moving forward, simply knowing that God might show up, and this sort of idea that perhaps the Lord will act on my behalf. And Jonathan decided he'd rather lean into a life of meaning than to live a life of boring, mundane existence. He'd rather die trying than to live a boring, fearful life. Look at me. Listen. We have to spend a lot less time devoting our lives to risk management. Think about how much energy we expend trying to make sure that life is safe and that every I is dotted and every T is crossed. And listen, if you're one of those people that wants everything spelled out, you're really going to wrestle with this. But that's not the way that God always designs us to live, because a life of faith means stepping into moments without always knowing that something great is going to happen. We have the advantage of hindsight in this story to see that Jonathan, he stepped out and God did some really great things, but he didn't know. So I kind of joked earlier about the word perhaps. Remember, perhaps the Lord. That's how Jonathan felt, but he was so committed to following God, he'd rather live a life where God could show up than to formulate this simple, easy life where God didn't need to show up. What if we shifted from just playing it safe and letting the world pass us by and started really saying and believing we could live a life where perhaps the Lord could act on our behalf? How might that change the way that you live? How might it shift the lives of your spouse and your children? How could it influence your coworkers and your neighbors and your friends if you shifted your life as one where perhaps the Lord could act on your behalf? What if God used you to help others see moments in life not only as things that happen to them, but as opportunities to be leveraged for the goodness of God? And what if we all as a community realized our stories are still being written? Did you know that? When you were early on in life and you looked down the pages of the book that was your life, you thought it was going to look this way. And if we're all honest, our lives probably look a lot different than that now, don't they? We can either be a victim and say, well, I guess I'll just follow the path of the story that's written for me, and miss out on the reality that your story is still being written. That's good news. Put a smile on your face. That's good news. You have an opportunity to choose those next few moments and what they're going to look like for you. I've been really trying hard the last few years to do that. About 4.5 years ago, I was reading this book, Chasing Daylight, and I should have known that God was going to use that to really mess with me. I was at a good place in life. I had a good job, a great family. We just bought a new house. I pretty much had everything figured out. You know how in life, you go through two times of having everything figured out. It's when you're a teenager, you think you know it all and have everything figured out, and then once as an adult, you think you have everything figured out, right? And the truth is, the older you get, after that moment, you realize how little you have figured out, right? The older you get, the more you realize you don't know. Well, I was at that earlier place where I had it all sort of figured out. And yet it's in those moments that it seems like God intervenes and really is an effort on his part to save us from ourselves. So Scott calls me out of the blue one day, and he says, "Hey, what do you think about us working together sometime?" I thought, hey, that sounds cool. You know, someday, we'd kind of talked about it in the past, and I thought, well, someday, that sounds really great. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, obviously not right now, because things are awesome, okay, and perfect, and I'm not changing a thing. I've got it all figured out. The spreadsheet's all, you know, formulated. I'm doing my thing. So a couple of months later, he called me back, and he goes, "Hey, how about now?" I thought, oh, man, that really screwed everything up. So I started looking into it and sort of figuring out what are the resources it's going to take for me to do this, and I found out it cost a lot more to live here than it did in Texas. And I wasn't going to be making any more money, and we didn't even have a specific job description. Didn't know exactly what I was going to be doing. He sort of felt like, hey, I believe you're supposed to be here. Let's get you here, and then we're going to figure out where you're supposed to be. I'm like, could life be any more ambiguous than this? And to be honest, it really scared the heck out of me. And I actually got to the point where I was going to tell Scott no. And I felt like God, like, tapped on me. And I think it's no coincidence that I happened to be reading that book at the same time, and this phrase started ringing through my head like a gong, man. Perhaps the Lord could act on your behalf. I'm like, I hate this story. This is stupid. And then I knew I had to do it. I had to position my life where I couldn't just coast comfortably to my death. I once heard it said that if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much space. And I realized that was true for me. I was a middle-of-the-road guy. I was playing it safe. And you know what? A lot of stuff happened to me when I was a kid that I realized worked against me really believing I could do a lot of things. So it was easier for me to sort of, it was like therapy for me to put all the puzzle pieces in their place and to not take a step of faith. But I knew that by staying there, I would never give God opportunities to do the kinds of things he would if I positioned myself where only he could show up. And I realized as a father, I had this responsibility. I wanted to model for my kids this exciting life of, who knows, we might die trying, but perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. And so I said yes, and a few months later, we moved to Illinois. And it's hard to imagine this, but in just a couple of weeks, it'll be 4 years since I started here at the Orchard. And I can honestly say in my life, I'm more creative. I'm more engaged in life. I love life far more than I did. I love people. I love my family more than ever. And I literally every Monday morning think to myself, I get to go to work today. How many of you say that? I like that. That is the exception. And I hear people say, oh man, it's Monday. I think, dude, you got one life to live, man. Get in a place that you want to get up and go make a difference. I feel like that about my job. And, you know, Scott's created an environment where he allows and he actually expects us to always wrestle with what it is God's saying to us and to position ourselves over on the edge to be in a place where perhaps God could act on our behalf. I remember telling him when I called him to say, I'll move, I remember saying something stupid like, well, I'm putting my life in your hands, you know. And he was like, don't put your life in my hands. You're putting it in the hands of God. He rephrased it in a way that really was good for me because perhaps the Lord could act on my behalf. And what's crazy is when you realize that that list of cumulative moments in your life can be filled with amazing, powerful events, it changes your perspective. And in the last 4 years, God has shown me so many amazing things. I've met so many amazing people. I've seen so many people grow and take steps in their life. I'm a part of a church community where if I weren't on staff, this is the community I'd still want to be a part of. I don't do this because I get a paycheck. I do this because this is where God has me. I love you people. I love what God's doing in our midst. It's pretty mind-blowing sometimes to see God doing all the things in our midst. I get to be a part of that. I see people like Tammy Halfrick, a good friend of mine who's a volunteer here at the Orchard, taking steps in our life to really learn how to love people well and to serve other people. And she's tirelessly pursuing stepping into those moments in her own life where perhaps God could act on her behalf. And she's now starting to challenge and encourage other people to do the same. I'm seeing people like Tom Reber, who's a small business owner, who stepped out in faith this year to launch his business big time. And man, he's having the time of his life. It's probably scarier than it's ever been for him. But he's taking steps to pursue a life where perhaps God could act on his behalf. And you might not like this, but I'm praying that God is going to mess you up. Start messing with that little bit of you that wants that, your little security gland. He's going to start squeezing that thing and making you think, oh, man, God's doing something and making me uncomfortable. And I'm believing that God is going to send people out of this place all around the world to really make a difference and to meet needs and to change the lives of people. I'm believing that God is going to stir in our hearts and make us uncomfortable and look at life differently and start looking at life sort of forward thinking rather than backward thinking. And in my own life, trying to do this has led me to a couple of new moments. A couple years ago, I was at a conference called Story, and the chairman of the UCLA program in screenwriting was doing a question and answer session. And I felt like the door of my heart was being knocked on. And I heard him talking about writing, and that little boy inside of me awoke. The one that was filled with wonder and mystery and the belief that we can create worlds, that we can do all kinds of things, and we can believe in the power of moments. And I remembered that as a kid, I loved to write. Remember that old Royal typewriter? It wasn't a word processor. It was a clackety, clackety, clack. And you had to put it in. You had to remember where the margins were and kind of manually line things up. There's something really cool about that. And so I thought, hey, I smell a moment coming on. And I got to work. And my friend Michael and I, we came up with this idea for a sitcom called Waste. And we actually wrote this sitcom, and we entered it into a bunch of script competitions. And man, what's crazy is we started getting these emails going, congratulations, you made it to the next round. And out of thousands of entries, we ended up making it to the top 10% of an international screenwriting competition. I couldn't believe it. I can't even tell you like how awesome that felt, because I was getting in touch with that little boy that believed in creativity and imagination and life. This past Christmas, I heard about a short film contest that Kevin Spacey's production company was doing. And so in 4 days' time, I went from this idea to I wrote an entire short film script, and I submitted it to this competition. And right as I was about to click submit, I realized that I had made an error with one of the rules for the contest and that my submission wasn't going to work. And so you know what I did? I deleted it. I'm kidding. I didn't delete it. Come on. You guys. Man, I had you right there, and that was awesome. I did not delete that, okay? I'm not dumb. So I actually did some rewriting and got it to a place I really liked, and I submitted it to some competitions, and again, I made it in that script to the top 25% of an international screenwriting competition. This past few months, came up with an idea for a web series and wrote an entire first season for a web series, and we put a team together, and some friends of mine and I are hoping over the next few months to shoot that web series and release 5 episodes to the world to have fun with. And right now I'm working on a short film that's kind of a dark short film. I've had it in my brain for a couple of years, and now I'm about halfway through, and I hope to finish this winter. And I really hope that I can shoot that short film next year. At The Orchard, I've been working on some things behind the scenes, some resources for things that I think are going to help a lot of other churches around the country. And you know what? To be honest, I'd love to tell you that I have the 5-year plan on all of this, but the truth is, I don't. And that's okay. Because I don't have to know where I'm going. I have to what? Just do something. And I'm trying to keep my ear to the ground and respond to moments as I see them. And God is really letting me discover some amazing things about myself and how I'm wired, and he's letting me see opportunities in our church, in our city, and around the world that I could actually make a difference and do some things with the way that God's wired me and gifted me. And I think a lot of it has to do that I'm starting to be able to see things differently, to see the world a little bit differently, a lot like I did when I was a young child. One day I was sitting at home with my 5-year-old son, and I had my camera, and I was practicing some film techniques and such, and I shot this little video. This is what I'm calling an Uber short, because it's really short. And I did it just to learn some things, but man, when I was done with it, I put a soundtrack to this, and I did some things to it, and God actually spoke to me through this. And so, have a look at the screen. Thank you. That's my son, and yes, he is so beautiful, we are wondering who the father is. Some of you will get that later. Don't kids have such beautiful, like, facial features, and hands are so cute, and you heard him going, pew, pew, pew. I was really inspired watching him play. I didn't coach him at all. I just said, can I film you while you're playing? And that's the great thing about having kids. If you're interested in doing film, is you get free actors, you know, which is a great thing. And it's like as I was cutting this together, it was like God was saying to me, hey, this is how children are. They have a soundtrack that's playing in their ears. And they see that there's a world there, and they're fully engaged in that. Their imaginations are fully engaged, and that's what I desire for you. Your imagination fully engaged, dreaming about the future. And I feel like that's starting to happen for me. I'm more creative and more productive and more inspired than ever. A few weeks ago, I was driving to work one morning, and I'm kind of a weird guy because when it gets cloudy and rainy, I get all kinds of energy, and in the winter, I'm alive and alert, you know. I know it's the opposite of most people. But I was driving to work, and one day I literally said out loud, the world is a creative playground. And I kind of laughed. I went, that's really dorky. And I was like, the world is a creative playground. And I'm like, stop saying this. This is stupid. Like, just cheesy. You're being like a massive cheese factory right now. But that was really the overflow of my heart. That's really how I see the world right now. I see people filled with opportunity. I see the world as a playground waiting to be engaged. And I do not want to end up at the end of my life wondering where all the good moments went. Do you? I refuse to end up at the end of my life in that place. And so I'm going to keep experimenting and just see what happens. One last thing I want to tell you about. My 35th birthday is coming up. In about two or three weeks. And I started thinking about my birthday, and I started imagining all the, you know, Apple Store and Starbucks gift cards I was going to get, thousands and thousands of dollars of gift cards that you were going to bring me. And I thought, you know what, let's do something different this year. And so on a Wednesday night, I had this idea, and I went, oh, man, this is big. I got to think through this. And on Thursday, I percolated all day. And by Thursday night, I was convinced I had to do it. So I called up some friends, and I said, I got this crazy idea. I need some help. I can't do this by myself. In about 4.5 days' time, we went from idea to launching a website on Monday a couple of weeks ago called losingtogive.com. And losingtogive.com, it's an opportunity where I'm trying to lose weight, and I'm inviting other people who need to lose weight to join me and try to lose as much as we can by November 11th, which is my birthday. And the idea was we're going to lose every single pound that we can, and we're going to invite people to come along on the journey, and they can sponsor us either with so much per pound, like $5 a pound we lose, or just a flat donation. And what's really, really cool, in 5 days' time, we did this, and all of the money goes to help the good people in Rwanda have clean drinking water. And you know what? All of that started just because I wanted to just do something. Why just have another boring birthday? We're all getting older, but why not do something about it? So we have about 10 losers now and a whole bunch of sponsors, and you're invited to go sponsor us as well. But that's a lot of fun. What about you? What are your defining moments? What are the 5 or 6 key moments and decisions that really define who you are? Maybe some of those moments you didn't choose, they happened to you, and they've kept you from moving forward in your life. I want you to know today that your story is still being written. I want you to know that those hopes and dreams that you had as a child, your imagination looking down through the pages of your life, they're still sitting there, and they're waiting for you to call out to them and say, I'm going to imagine what the life could look like. Your story is still being written. And my prayer is that we see a community filled with bold prayers, people who would ask God to disturb them and put them into places never imagined, and to embrace uncertainty and let the need for security go away in pursuit of the goodness and the glory of God. Because perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Would you pray with me? I want to close by praying over us a prayer largely attributed to the 16th century adventurer Sir Francis Drake. Disturb us, O Lord, when we're too pleased with ourselves, when our dreams have come true because we dreamed too little, when we arrived safely because we sailed too close to the shore. Disturb us, Lord, when with the abundance of things we possess, we've lost our thirst for the waters of life. Having fallen in love with life, we've ceased to dream of eternity. And in our efforts to build a new earth, we've allowed our vision of the new heaven to dim. Disturb us, Lord, to dare more boldly, to venture on wilder seas where storms will show your mastery. We're losing sight of land, we shall find the stars. We ask you to push back the horizon of our hopes and to push back the future in strength, courage, hope, and love. And this we ask in the name of our captain, who is Jesus Christ. Amen.